Welcome to chapter 16 of Job. As Job takes back the microphone from Eliphaz. And what we're going to see in chapters 16 and 17 is Job's response to Eliphaz's second speech. And I thought it would be instructive to begin by looking back at how he responded to Eliphaz's first speech. And then we'll be able to compare. And you have an empty box on the page. That's homework to fill in. It will not be graded. It will not be on the final. Looking at the boxes, though, on the sheet, going back to chapters 4 and 5, which were when Eliphaz spoke the first time addressing Job. So Eliphaz had presented three ideas. One, that people deserve to suffer. Whatever suffering happens to them, not people deserve to suffer, that's the wrong way to say it. If people are suffering, it's because they deserve it. If someone isn't suffering, obviously they don't deserve it, but otherwise they do. Getting upset and angry about it is foolish. It ignores the fact that it's all justified. And finally, you should turn to God, and then there will be hope, and God will help you. The narrative of hope. To which Job replied, first of all, by saying, "I never asked for your help." Although he also said, "The help that you're providing is not what I need." So it's sort of two points in one. I never asked for your help, and the help you're providing isn't what I would have asked for had I been asking for help in the first place. And then, in terms of Eliphaz's points, he actually responds fairly directly. Eliphaz said people deserve their suffering. Job replies, God has smashed me, or alternatively, depending on how you read his point, God has allowed me to be smashed. Eliphaz had said outrage is foolish, and Job responded, God forced me to be outraged by the way he treated me. Eliphaz said turn to God for help, and Job's reply is, there is no hopeful narrative, there's no vision of, in the end, things will be better. And so I do turn to God, but in defiance. That was his response the first time. So it was fairly on point. Granted that you had to struggle with the text a little to get there, but it was fairly on point. Eliphaz's second speech, which we just read the last 2 weeks, said three things. Number one, Job, you are wicked when you deny the value of goodness. You claim there is no justice, it leads people astray. You claim that being good is irrelevant because man can't satisfy God. So, Job, you're denying the value of goodness. You are wicked, Job. That's number one. Number two, you are arrogant. You claim that you know everything. You say that that we are foolish. You say you are old and experienced and worldly. And all of this is arrogance. And then third, he said, the wicked suffer. They suffer in their fear of what is going to happen to them. They suffer from the lack of a future. And so, indeed, there is justice in this world. That was Eliphaz's second speech. It took us a couple of weeks, but we got through it. And so now what we're going to see is Job's reply. And I gave you an outline in source number one right below the box. It is, once again, a two-chapter response, because if you're Job, why take one chapter when you could take two? It's your book. And he begins, once again, by rejecting the words of the person speaking to him. This is consistent. He says, you are foolish, you lack comprehension. He says, God has crushed me on multiple levels, as he describes. I am innocent, and therefore I turn to God demanding justice. Then in chapter 17, he will shift into saying, God has robbed me of support, and what he means by support, we'll see. And I suffer greatly, and I have no hope. So we're going to have to see as we go through how this is a reaction to Eliphaz, if at all. With some of the speakers, Job has not responded directly, as we'll see when we go through each in turn. But is this a response to Eliphaz, and if so, how? And then the other question, is Job breaking new ground here? Or is he simply going to reiterate that which he has already said? And I'm mindful of what we said in the beginning of the book when we pointed out, I think it was Malbim who said, this is a really hard book to read because people seem to go around and around saying the same thing they said in the previous chapter, but we've already seen that that's not quite true. You just have to read really carefully, and then you find that there are elements that are new, and we will see at least one new element in Job's presentation in chapters 16 and 17. So there is that which is new. I believe there's that which is new here. Where is it? Clear so far? And then once we've done that, then we can fill in that empty box with Job's reply 16 and 17 and see just what he has added, how indeed he has responded to the statements of Eliphaz. Okay. We are on page 1641 if you're using the Art Scroll Tanakh. And we begin with the start of his speech, in which he rejects their words as we said, foolish and lacking in comprehension. And this is a familiar ritual. This is the way that each one starts his speech, by rejecting the words of the other one. It almost, in truth, going back to conversation we had in the very beginning, when we talked about the question of whether this was supposed to be the actual words of a conversation being reproduced, or whether this was entirely a parable, or whether this was modeled on a dialogue that had happened, but stylized. So this, the fact that we see this so consistently each time, that each one begins a speech in this way, supports the idea that it's actually either a stylized thing, where there was a real dialogue and then somebody took it and turned it into an art form, or that it was a parable from the beginning. But it is possible that was just what you did. This was the norm. In the same way that today, people get up to speak in response to somebody else, they start with all due respect. So what they're doing in three or four verses is what the person saying with all due respect really means, which is, you don't know what you're talking about, allow me to correct you. That's you know, just a more honest version of with all due respect. So that could be. Ralph, you were going to say?
This is verse, right?
Yes.
The whole thing?
Much verse. Yeah. Sorry. Yes, it is verse.
So it is stylized.
I think so. And you could make the argument that people do speak a certain way, but yes. So let's take a look at the passage here, the opening passage, sentences 1 to 5. As all of them began, Vayan Iyo Vayomar, he declared and he said, Shamati Che'ele Rabos Menachamei Amal Kulchem. I've heard so much like this. Okay, what you're telling me is old news. I've heard this before. You are Menachamei Amal, and the word Amal is a word that we've seen before as a loaded word in this book. It's one of those words that I want to come back to once we've actually seen the whole thing and look at how it's used. But Amal has a connotation of struggle which bears no fruit. It is not struggle that you enjoy. It's struggle that is just going to be for nothing. And it also has a connotation of evil in this book. Not normally. Amal is not normally like that, but as it's used in Iyov, it's often meant to imply some kind of effort to achieve a wicked end, a wicked purpose. So there's a value judgment. Number one, it is useless. And number two, it is evil. So that's what he says to them. Now, when he calls them Menachamei Amal, comforters of Amal, this word for vain struggle and for wickedness, he is echoing something that they said, something that Eliphaz had said to him. If you flip back to chapter 15, sentence 11. Right? You see that there? Hama'at mimcha tanchumot kale. Are the consolations of God little for you? They're too little for you to get that which you need. And we discussed what the consolations of God are. Does that mean the good things God has given him? Does it mean their words representing God? But either way, Job is responding to that line. Eliphaz said, "Are the comforts of God too little for you?" To which he responds, "Shamati ka'ila rabot." Oh my God, I've heard so much. Rabot versus ma'at. Right? You ask me if I've heard a little? I've heard a lot. And as far as the comfort being the comfort of God, the comfort that people are offering me is amal, is worthless, vain, even wicked struggle. So that's Job's response. It would be good to have an edition of Job that actually had arrows going from one to the other, so that would make it easier to find these. But I think that's a response there. That's what he's saying to them. And he continues. We're going to come back to this line. There's something else I want to say, but let's read the passage. Pasuk Gimel, sentence 3. Haketz ledivrei ruach. Is there any end to words of air? And words of air, calling someone's speech ruach, is another thing which we've seen repeatedly in this book. Omayam ritzcha ki ta'aneh. That's a very interesting word, yamritzcha. What is a tamritz in modern Hebrew? No. An incentive. It's a goad, something that causes you to do something. Ma yamritzcha kisane. What is your incentive for responding? He says. Why are you continuing this dialogue with me? It's not as though it's been any more satisfying for you three than it's been for me until now. Why in the world do you keep on going? Is there no end to your words of wind, of air? Like, are you guys going to run out of steam at some point, literally and figuratively? Divrei Ruach. He says, in Pasuk Dalet, Gam Anochi Kachem Adabera, I can speak just like you. Lu yesh nafshechem tachas nafshi. And here, this is a very interesting approach. There are two different ways you could take this, but literally reading it, lu yesh nafshechem tachas nafshi. If your lives were in place of mine, if you were in my shoes, and I were in your place, achbira aleichem bimilim, I would join with you with words. V'ania aleichem b'moroshi, and I would shake my head at your terrible suffering. Amitzchem b'mofi, I would give you omets, I would give you strength with my mouth. Mo, this moroshi, mofi, is a poetic form that's seen sometimes in Tanakh. I wouldn't spend a lot of time on that. But he says, I would strengthen you with my mouth. The movement of my lips would save you from trouble. If you were in my shoes, I would shake my head over your suffering. I would speak words to join with you. That's what he says in his introduction. So he begins by blasting them. Right? Your words are empty. I wish they would end already. You talk about the comforts of God. Your comforts are empty and wicked and worthless. In that line, before we go to the second part of what he would do if their roles were reversed, take a look at source number 2 on your sheet, please. The commentary of Rabbi David Al-Shuler, the Mitzudat David. He says to them, it's a substantive response. It's not just an insult. Kulchem menachamei tanchumei hevel. All of you provide comfort of hevel, that which is futile and empty. Lomar shacharat shuva yisgeh achariti, saying that if I'll only repent, then my end will be good and I will flourish. Vim ein biyadi avon mamakom l'tshuva, but I haven't sinned. And if I haven't sinned, what room is there for repentance? You're telling me all about how the wicked suffer as a means of inspiring me to repent. That's why Mitzudat David understands what Eliphaz had been doing, trying to inspire repentance. He says, what's the point? I'm not a bad guy. I haven't done anything wrong. So there, says Job. So Job's statement is, what you're providing me is worthless from a functional standpoint. Because you're trying to get me to repent, but that's all completely meaningless and empty. It has no worth to me. And if I were in your shoes, This is what I would do. I would speak and I would shake my head. So looking at sentences 4 and 5, that's really what I want to grab here, because I find this fascinating when he says this to them. What is he saying here? When he says, if I were in your shoes and you were in my shoes, I would join myself to you with words, I would shake my head. What does that mean? Uplifting, I would have compassion.
I wouldn't reprimand.
Wouldn't reprimand. Yeah.
I
yeah.
would do the same thing.
I would be the same as you.
I don't think he'd say the same thing.
Don't think he would say the same? Keep in mind, he would have to be in their shoes from before he experienced this. And therefore, before potentially he learned the lesson of how he responds when they say things. Remember that Eliphaz's first speech. Eliphaz said to him, you know, I've heard you give comfort to people before and strengthen people before. It's entirely possible that he's relating back to that comment of Eliphaz and saying, if I were actually coming to comfort, I would. And then I don't know, because right now I have 4 or 5 people who have said he would be good in responding. And I have one, Sharon, who says, no, he would actually be just as bad as they are. Susan.
Didn't you just say he said he would shake his head?
Yes.
So he's not saying it. What he may be saying also is, I might think things, but I wouldn't do as you are doing and say them.
The problem is, you're right, but earlier in the same sentence, he said, Achbira alechem b'milim, I would join myself to you with words.
But words against them? Against
so we, right now we don't know. It's subject to debate.
Because I wonder if he's saying it against those who were condemning. And to the quote-unquote, I would not say anything. I may think it.
Right.
But I wouldn't say.
So I think there's something to be said for that. I want to hear what people have to say here, and then offer a couple of possibilities. Stephen.
I don't get it. What's it all about? That's when you shake your head or you shrug your shoulders. That's exactly what everybody's saying in their mind, isn't it? I don't get it. I don't know what this is all about.
Not necessarily. Sometimes I think it's a message of saying, like, what a shame. You know?
Or tis.
Yeah.
Tis.
Yeah.
I think his friends have a lot of nerve to say that he's wicked because he's suffering. But I don't know, say you yourself, you ran into a person you know, isn't that nice, a person who tells you he has trouble? They're going to say, oh, yeah, well, you deserve that.
Well, he means it in the nicest way possible. I mean, in all seriousness, the way that people read this book, and we've said this before, the way that people read this book tends to be much more sympathetic to Job and to look at the 3 visitors as really clowns who are just there as a foil for him so that he can show us the way a human being ought to behave, and they're showing us the way a human being ought not to behave. And there's a certain support for that from the fact that in the end, God is going to insult them and throw aside their words. Having said that, I'm still of the belief that we've seen from others here that the 3 visitors are not meant to be empty. We're not wasting our time by reading what they have to say. There is something of substance in their arguments. Whether it's the nicest thing to say to somebody who is suffering is a separate point. But there may well be something to learn from each of them. I've already seen things in each of them that I thought made worthwhile points. Debbie.
Well, this is a challenge of between God and Satan, of the satanic part of God. Are these 2 people not elements of the satanic?
So we've been saying,
right,
and leaving aside the relationship between the Satan and God and what's happening there, because that we spent enough time being confused about in the opening weeks, we don't need to add to the confusion now. But the in terms of your main point, absolutely, I reiterate, the visitors are part of his test.
Yeah, keep pulling.
Yeah.
So you can get him on the other side.
But you know, it's not a test if they're completely foolish. You know, the person, the king passing through the street is insulted by some peasant, it doesn't mean anything. If he's insulted by somebody whose word actually counts for something, you get a reaction.
Yeah, but they're his friends.
Well, so to speak.
Well, they're the people he considers to be among his friends, therefore their judgment is meaningful.
I don't know what he considers them. We don't know that. Yeah.
I think Job's saying, you know, and this one actually experiences something each in our roles, playing out our roles. So there's a difference between us. We can't preach because I'm suffering. You comment on the suffering.
Mm-hmm. So he's highlighting that by saying if the roles were reversed,
I would be doing the same thing. It's experience that comes.
Right. Indeed possible. Very possible. Yishai and then Shaina.
We're looking really at the character. We're looking at the poetry, and that's wonderful. I love it. But I think part of understanding is that these are formal arguments. These are not just like Eliphaz gets up and says, hey, you know what? So everyone here is answering the same question. Why do the righteous suffer? Why do the wicked prosper? That's the question.
Maybe.
So Eliphaz is advancing a formal argument. God will be just in the end. It will all work out here. If you give up along the way, it's your own darn fault. That's one argument that we hear all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he brings it, and Dio says, I think here, not just, I wouldn't speak like you or I would. I think what he's saying is, I know that formal argument. Don't bring it here. I've done that long ago. I've schlugged it up. I'm not interested. Oh, you have another philosophical argument, and they start. That's what he's saying. You're speaking a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Give a little hint, but really we know what you're talking about. It's on top of this in the Gemara, right? He's shutting them down. But for us, that is valuable, because it's a collection of every possible answer to that question.
Right. So one way to look at it is indeed to say, and this goes back to Sharon's idea, that he's saying, I would give the same words you do, because I know those words, and I've used those words myself. Right. Absolutely possible. It's just another form of him saying to them, stop talking already. Shaina.
Just on the question of what not in the head means.
Yeah.
I remembered it. I found it in Esau chapter 2.
The new outline of
Rashi. When the daughter of Zion is mourning, and the passersby nod their head at her.
Right.
Their hands rejoice over her suffering.
Right. There are a few places in Tanakh where we find that kind of a reference, and it's generally commiserating with suffering or saying, oh, wow, is that bad? Not necessarily commiserating, but just saying, that's awful. Rita, you were going to say? I feel like the whole thing's been. I mean, the suffering itself was part of the test.
So the friends are part of the test.
Well, again, let's go back to the initial point that was made, where the Satan statement to God is, nobody is loyal to you, God. There is no one out there, God, who actually wants a relationship with you. And God's response is to say, you can't say that because there's at least one person on earth who does want that connection with me, who is loyal. And so this entire book has been an attempt to push him to the point where he will deny effectively the relationship and say, I don't want a relationship. I don't want anything to do with God. So absolutely, they're continually, you know, pushing him further. So that's what I see. But what I want to show you here is within this passage, which I think is such a great passage about the way that, you know, if I were in your shoes and you were in my shoes type of thing, take a look at source number 3 on your sheet, please. Rashi brings one approach, which is a common approach. This is the less common approach, but Sharon said it and others said it. Kachem adabera. Kachem ani yodea likanter. Like you, I know how to attack. I know how to get people upset. I could do the same thing to you. Which is not necessarily a deep philosophical reflection, as much as he's saying, I could also give people a hard time. That's one way to look at it. But I actually think that he is saying that I would do things in a positive way. I wouldn't do things in the way that you do. And I think it's betrayed by one of the words that he uses. But take a look first at source number 4. Malbim writes the following: Hachi gam anochi kachem adabera. Would I speak as you do? Bitmia, it's an expression of shock, of wonder. How could you think that? If such a thing were to happen to you, and you would be the people who were struck with boils instead of me, and I came to comfort you, would I speak like you to declare you wicked and to pain your hearts? Lochain, nonsense. Ki behefecha yisiosa. I would do the opposite. Achbira aleichem b'milim. I would join upon you with words, and I want to come back to that phrase. Two different approaches. One approach is, I would do this the right way. And the other approach is, I would do this the wrong way, just like you're doing it. Right? Malbim saying, I would do it right. Rashi saying, I would do it wrong. When you look at the words themselves, I do think that there is a hint to the view that it is, I would do it the right way. And that is the very funny verb in sentence four.
Chaver.
Right. Ach bira. Right? Chaver. Chevra. Companionship. Right? I would join myself to you with words. Because that is the one thing that they haven't done. What's been missing so far is sympathy. And not only sympathy, but sympathy maybe, but empathy. To feel what he is feeling as though they are in pain also has been entirely missing from the speeches from the very start. And more, when you declare somebody else to be wicked, you immediately put space between yourself and them. I'm the good guy, he's the bad guy. Right? I would like to draw him near. I would like to make him good and then he would be like me. But right now, I'm here and he's there. So that what he's saying is, as I understand it, and it's I'm resting on this word achbira, what he's saying is, I would show friendship.
Empathy,
friendship, companionship, you would be part of a community with me. And I wouldn't put myself at a spiritual remove as well as an emotional remove in which there's no sympathy and there's no sense of you're a good guy just like us. Yes, Susan.
You said that the friends are not just a foil to joke, but have validity of what they're saying.
Yes.
So, even though we take what Job is saying at this point, that everything you've done is the wrong way, we take it as the second.
Yeah.
And you said you've already seen some validity in what they said.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, I hope I've been pointing it out as we've seen it.
Okay.
So far, for example, when made his statement that people suffer not necessarily because they've done something wrong, but because they haven't lived up to the potential that they have. Even if I don't like the idea, and I don't, because I have real problems with it. Nonetheless, I think it's a really interesting way to approach the problem of reward and punishment in this world without having to throw up your hands and say, well, that's it, there's no justice here. Yeah, I think it's an interesting approach that should be reviewed. When Bildad makes the point that there are times when suffering leads to good results. Yeah, I think that's a valid point. It may not explain 100% of cases. It may not be comforting to the person who is in pain right now. For some people who are in pain, it may be very comforting. But I think that there's legitimacy to it. So that's an example of something that I see. I can't see, and maybe this is just because I can't believe I invested so much time in their chapters. I can't believe it was all for nothing. But I think there really is substance to what we're saying here. And yeah.
Just the substance can be, I can also in being the foil to Job, Shakespearean in that way, that they create the situation. Like here, where we have the two approaches of Job, we wouldn't have any of this without them. We need them to create not only the positives and negatives in Job, but also concepts that make us think of righteousness and
right.
What is it and what who should suffer.
Right, and that actually begs a really interesting question that we can't answer. It's one of these what ifs. But what if the visitors had never come? What if Job is struck the second time, his wife says to him, blaspheme and die, and he responds as he responds, fairly powerful, and then nobody shows up?
We never will.
Well, that's the thing. We don't know.
Die of hope. But you might have him thinking about it and then finally...
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I think that their role is really important, and it's true. Some of it really is the test of Job, the pushing of him, the development of his thought as he goes along. I mean, what we effectively see, and this is going to come out really strongly in the next chapter, in chapter 17, we are seeing with each speech a different Job. It's not the same, I mean, it's the same person in the sense that he had the same starting point of having been good and having been careful and so on, and then suffering this, you know, suffering the loss, but he's in a different spiritual place each time he shows up. And even if he's consistent in things like trash-talking the visitors, nonetheless, there's continually something different showing up in his speech. As I said, chapter 17, he's going to make a leap that we have not seen from him yet, that's fundamentally different from what you would have seen in his last speech in chapters 12 to 14. There was a hand somewhere here. Yeah.
But isn't he in some ways a threat to them and their philosophical belief of, you know, reward and punishment? So their speeches are also sort of this collective. We can't all be wrong, so you must be wrong. Because, you know, we're on the good side, right? So it's also sort of that majority wins all this thing. But he's very much a threat to them. How could he get punished when there's nothing wrong? There must be something. So you've got to justify.
Oh, yeah. You know, absolutely.
It's not great. It's not just for his sake. It's for their own sake.
Yeah.
They have to say this.
Agreed. And that's a point that Sofar made. When Sofar started to speak, he said, I have to speak up because there are people listening, and they're going to get, you know, led astray by you. And it's a point that that Eliphaz made in his second speech when he said, you are going to destroy, you know, Tefillah, Torah, however we read, you know, Eliphaz's opening remarks. And it's a point that Job has seized on in responding to them, saying, you know, you think you're going to respond to me and that way you're going to make this whole world work out all right and everything is fine and dandy. And it doesn't work that way. So absolutely, that's very much a part of the current in this dialogue. Let's go a little further because we have, you know, not much time. But that's his opening salvo, is to say to them, your words are foolish in understanding, and if I were in your shoes, either I would be as foolish as you, but I know how to say what you say, as Yishai pointed out, or I would be compassionate. I would be empathetic. I would not distance myself from you. I would join with you. Okay, that brings us to sentences 6 to 16. And here, yeah. What do you mean?
He seems to be implying to them that he's, their concern is legitimate, that he is saying, I have a higher, I have a more expanded consciousness than you. The divine presence rests on me, and when I get it, you don't get it.
Now, where do you see that?
Just the comment that you just gave us. Yeah, there's always a reference. You know, just have to find the sentence. Can you read out the sentence?
The one that, the sentence is, what, 2 to 5? Yeah.
The whole essence of Kabbalah is unification, right? As opposed to fragmentation. So fragmentation itself is sitra hara. It's inherently divisive, inherently not desirable. Whereas I think what he's saying,
so my ability to join with
you. If rested on you, you would bring people together. You wouldn't split them apart.
It's an interesting idea. Could be. I mean, I would also note here that the very fact that he says, if this had happened to you, is probably offensive to them. Because it suggests that it could have happened to them. Meaning, in their mind, these things only happen to bad people. Right? It's sort of like, you know, if somebody, I don't know, somebody gets a ticket for, like, reckless driving, right? And someone else is down talking to me, because, you know, if you had gotten a ticket for reckless driving, well, I don't drive recklessly. What do you mean? It would never have happened to me, says the guy who was trained in Washington Heights, New York, how to drive. That's neither here nor there. But it's sort of, it's an offensive statement to them. What do you mean, if I were in your shoes? I would never end up in those shoes. Yeah, I think that there's a little bit of an insult going on, and a dig, like, you know, this could be you. Shana?
That's the whole psychological foundation for the entire world. Their desire to differentiate themselves from him and say, what happened to me doesn't happen to us.
Yeah, no, I think so, and I think that's part of this whole gap. I agree. Okay, yeah.
Just really quickly, but you know how you always say that they mirror the same words? So it is a lot of very same words of what Eliphaz says when he talks about, like, milim and sikha. He uses lashon, or like he's using the same words in the speech. And so he's just sort of, those words that you're supposed to say that I'm using foolishly, well, your words are.
It's the same words.
The same word.
Yeah, it's a good point. Thank you. So, looking at Psukim Vav to Tet Zayin, sentences 6 to 16, where Job talks about God having crushed him. So, this is going to be particularly interesting in my mind, because, but actually here, it's not even chapter 17, it's chapter 16 where we're going to see him take his big step. But the it's interesting because Job is going to describe God as harming him. He hasn't done that since chapter 6. Chapter 6 and 7 were the last time that he did this. If you flip back quickly to chapter 6, the beginning of the chapter, the first 10 verses. This was the last time he responded to Eliphaz. So there's something in Eliphaz that moves Job in this direction. It was page 1627. Right? So look at what he said there, particularly as you look at sentence 4. Ki chitzei shakai imadi, the arrows of God are with me. God has shot his arrows at me. Asher chamasam shosa ruchi, my spirit drinks their poison. Biusei alokai arhuni, the fears generated by God. This is him describing what God is doing to him. Right? Pasuk Tet, sentence 9. V'yo'el alokavi dak'eni yater yadovi vatsa'eni. God crushes me, he lowers me. This is his description of what God does to him. He hasn't done that in 10 chapters. Since then, he responded to Bildad, he responded to Tzofar, and didn't mention this. Eliphaz, with his statement of God punishes the wicked, or maybe more, Eliphaz with his open claim that if you turn to God, God will save you, gets this response from Job. Because Job says to him, God has smashed me with such violence that he's clearly my enemy. And so you claim that God is going to be on my side. That's just unacceptable. It can't be. And so I'm going to underscore now what it is that God does to me. You follow? That's point number one for this section. Point number two for this section is, watch the way he addresses God. Because there's one point in which he goes back and forth about something critical. So watch that as we read through these verses. Starting with Pasuk Vav, sentence 6. So we're back again on page 1641. He says, Im adabara, if I will speak, and he's not now speaking where they're suffering, he's speaking where he is suffering. Im adabara lo yechaseich ke'evi, my pain will not be spared me. And there's a play on words, because he used the word yachsoch just back in sentence 6, right? Talking about there, my movement of my lips would save you from your suffering. Well, if I would speak, it wouldn't save me from my pain. V'achdela ma'mini yahaloch, and he says if I would stop speaking, if I would be silent, what would leave me? Neither speech nor silence is improving my condition. If you take a look at source number 6. No, not number 6. I didn't bring it on the sheet. Sorry, I thought I was bringing it. But Mitzudat David, in his commentary here, says that Job is saying to them, you say that I suffer because I speak out against God, and because my speech undermines people's faith. Well, my silence isn't any better. Being silent doesn't make things better. He tried that, right? He spent 7 days not saying anything. It didn't help. So, from his perspective, neither speech nor silence is on his side. So he says, "Ach atahel ani, Hashimosa kol adasi." This is fascinating. I want to hear how your translations render this sentence. I'm reading it the way it appears in the Art Scroll, although there are multiple ways you can do it. Oh, how it has wearied me. You shocked my entire clan into silence. That's the Art Scroll version of this. Clan, group, Eda. Someone who has a different translation. Susan, what do you have?
But now he hath made me weary. Thou hast made desolate all my company.
Excellent. What's changed between the two versions?
He blames God.
In the first one, he blamed. In the Art Scroll one, oh, how it has wearied me. You shocked my entire clan into silence. Who's he blaming?
Them or the disease or whatever.
So we have two problems. First problem is what's an it, and the second problem is what's a you. And don't say a lamb. What do you have, Debbie, in your translation?
Okay, JPS says, now he with a capital.
Okay.
He has truly warned me out to have destroyed my whole community.
Okay. What we are saying in the second half is easier than the first. The you here, capital Y, is a reference to God. You, God, have done this to me. In the first half of the sentence, he's also describing God. It with a capital I, so to speak. Or he with a capital H, as was rendered in those latter two editions. What has he done in mid-sentence?
Dialogue with God instead of friends.
Right. He's turning towards God. He changed. Exactly. He changed from second from third person to second person. He, God, has done this. You, God, have done this. Right? He's turning away from the friends, and he's going to now have a conversation with God. But watch how it plays out now. Keep reading. Vatik miteni. Le'ed haya. We're at sentence 8. Vayakam bicha hashi befanai ya'aneh. As the Art Scroll translates it, you, still talking to God, wizened me. The kmatim in Hebrew is wrinkles. Wrinkles increases. So you wrinkled me, but I guess wizened sounded better than you wrinkled me. Wrinkled me. Right. Yeah. Shriveled is good. I like shriveled. Okay. It has become a witness against me. My weakened body has stood up against me and has given testimony to my face. So he describes how he has been crushed, creased, shriveled, whatever, by God, speaking to God directly. It, meaning the wrinkling, the crushing, has been a witness against me for reasons that we'll come back to in a moment. In my own face, it testifies against me. But then look at sentence 9. Apo taraf vayistemeni. You see that? Back to third person, correct. Sentence 9 as translated here. His anger, has torn at me. Charak alai b'shi, vayistemeni, I'm sorry, vayistemeni is he hated me. How do I do it here? Despised me. Charak alai b'shinav, he gnashed his teeth against me. Tsari yiltosh einav li, my enemy brandishes or flashes his eyes at me. This is very important on multiple levels. What do you see here in this sequence that we're looking at? Obviously, one is that he's going back and forth between speaking to God and speaking about God. Right? That's one point here that's fascinating. A second point, just to show you as we're looking at this, flip the page for... No, I didn't bring it to you. Never mind. I was going to give you a link. I know why I didn't. I didn't because... Yeah, we're going to get to it. Never mind. The point that he's trying to make here, first of all, is accentuated by switching between second person and third person. If you take a look on your sheet first at source number 6, this is a good way to do it. Dat Mikra says, the Amos Chacham, Machmas hagashaso shekaso shel Elokim chol alav, because of his feeling that God's anger was upon him. Shuv einu yachol daber Elokim b'lashon nochach. He can't speak to God directly anymore. V'chozerum daber alav b'lashon nistar, and he goes back to addressing God in third person. I can't speak to God directly. You know, when someone is really angry at you, you don't want to face them head on. And it isn't about divine power. It's about just the discomfort of it. You don't speak to someone directly when they're that angry. And he says, that's the way I feel that God is here. Debbie?
He has an audience. Job have an audience.
Well, at least the three visitors. Yes, and here. As we've seen indications, there are more people there who are silent.
Why did you do this to me? Look at what he did to me. I mean,
but he's doing it in the same sentence. He's going back and forth in the same sentence.
There's an audience, I can understand.
Well, certainly it makes it more like a play to a certain extent. He's just shot the fourth wall. They agreed. If you take a look at source number 7, just to take a look at number 7 first, the Ralbag, building this same point, I think building this same point, he notes that this isn't the only place in Tanakh where this happens. He says, Pam lenochach upam shalo lenochach, sometimes direct, sometimes indirect. Al derech omro, like the pasuk, this is the beginning of Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs, Moshcheini, Acharecha Narutza. Heviani Amalachadarav. We turn to God and we say, draw me, meaning draw me near. We will run after you. The king, he's suddenly speaking about God indirectly, has brought me to his chambers. So he notes that this occurs elsewhere in Tanakh, and again, it's an experience of strong emotion. And that may be similar to or different, or I'm not sure what that mikra is suggesting here. But there's clearly strong emotion in the words. I mean, you can see that directly. Yisha, what were you going to say?
I think first of all, he's showing the friends what he's saying. He's saying, I am still connected to God. You think that this is all Epicurus, but this is actually an emistic process. I'm trying to figure out. You can't interfere because you haven't reached that level. I think it's also a huge smack in the face to Eliphaz, because there's nothing worse if you're talking to a person and they just actually turn away from you and say to their friend, when's the bus coming? Right? That's like, or good job is, right? So I think that's effectively what he's doing. He's saying, like, you three are useless. God, why are you sending me these idiots? Let's just talk and get it between us, right?
Could be, although it seems like he's... I'm not sure that I see it that way, but I could see... Somewhat. I mean, he has done that directly before, where he has said, I just want to talk to God and I'm tired of them. That we've seen directly. Diana and then Shana.
The word yistameni, and when he says he, it's almost like he has an intimation of the Satan having been a partner with God. And so that could possibly explain the back and forth of you and he, and then they open their mouths against me. So it's almost like he has an intimation of what went on. I know he couldn't possibly have.
It's funny that you say it. Hold the thought about the Satan, because we're going to see it come out very strongly in another sentence. So it's a good point. Hang in there with that. Shana.
On the second versus third person, in a way I can read it in the reverse from John McGraw, because to speak to someone in the third person in that culture at that time was the mark of respect. Would the king like? Uh-huh. Would my father want?
Interesting.
To directly say you is disrespectful.
I like it. The only question I have is, has he shown any other sign of respect in the last few chapters?
No.
So I'd be surprised to see him speaking to God in a respectful tone of voice at this stage. But I agree with you in general. In that culture, absolutely, it's Adoni HaMelech. You know, it's not a direct statement. That's certainly true. So he says here, God, you have worn me out. You've destroyed my group, my supporters, whether that's his family, his property, his friends. You crumbled me, God. And here, I wanted to note for you, I didn't bring it on the sheet because instead I brought it in source number 9, the idea that I'm getting at here. Ugh, there's so much to say. I don't know what you're doing. All right, we have 5 minutes. I'm going to take you back to number 8 for a second, and then I'll take you to number 5, to number 9. In number 8, he's talking about how neither his speech nor his silence helps. So Mitzudat David reads it this way. He says, V'im bazet hachshavu lachdil amarai, b'meshetom rushani mefer hayir ah. Asher he owed Sibalaval Yelchua Yisurim. He says, if you're going to try to tell me that I should stop talking because I eliminate people's reverence and awe for God, as indeed have been claimed by Tzofar, and that's another reason why my pains don't leave, because I keep on talking this way. He says, it's not true. He says, just like speaking doesn't cause my pain to go away, not speaking ain't any better. That's not solving my problems. But his reasoning is, he says, I have no sin to be cleansed of, such that if I'm just quiet and I accept my pain, then things will be better. I've done nothing wrong, which Mitzvah David saw him saying already earlier in the chapter. But one thing that I really wanted to grab here is sentence 8, when he says, my suffering, the wrinkling and all that, is testimony against me. Take a look at source number 9. I think this is anachronistic, but I find it really interesting anyway. Remember that Malbim is writing in the 18th century. He says, it is known in the history of early nations, Kishayi wrote Sim Livchon as Ish Nechshad Gneva Veretzach V'Yeser Averos V'Yamat Chish, when they wanted to test somebody, they wanted to try somebody who was suspected of theft or murder or some other sin, and he denied the charges. Hayumi Asrim Es Nechshad V'Yisrim Kashim Umarim. They would cause people to suffer. They would cause the defendant to suffer bitterly. Right? Do you know what this was called? It's a common phrase. Trial by ordeal. When people use the phrase trial by ordeal, this is what they mean. They would look at the face of the person who was being tortured. And if they see that he is enduring the suffering as though he doesn't feel it, they would conclude, oh, must be false, because he's being spared pain from the torture that we are carrying out. And if they saw that it hurt him, if certainly we shriek Hamas as Job did, they said, okay, must be true. They would conclude the claim was true. That was trial by ordeal. So he says that's what Job is referring to here. When he says, my suffering is taken as testimony against me. You look at the fact that I'm in pain and I'm shrieking and say, aha, guilty. Now again, I think trial by ordeal is post-biblical. So I think it's a little bit anachronistic, but the concept of it, that this demonstrates his guilt, the fact that he's suffering demonstrates that he's guilty, because otherwise God wouldn't be torturing him, is certainly a theme that we've seen in Eliphaz significantly. The last thing I'm going to note, which we're going to have to start with next time, is what we just read in sentence 9. He did something here which he hasn't done yet. What did he do?
Hates me.
More? True, but more. There's another word there. Enemy. For the very first time, he has called God his enemy. He has called God my enemy. That didn't happen earlier.
Where does
he know? Sentence 9. Sari. Sari yiltosh einav li.
Art school takes that right out.
What did they do?
Art school shouldn't be allowed to translate.
No, they didn't. It says my foe. My foe. They just didn't capitalize, you know, foe. But that's what, no, foe and enemy, that's what they're doing. Oh, but what art school did do is note, and this is what I was commenting, Diana, Rashi here can't accept that. And Rashi says, my foe, my enemy here is the Satan. It can't be, because Job doesn't know. If Job knew it was the Satan, this whole story would have a very different cast to it. That's what I'm saying. The Rashi says that it is indeed the Satan. He could be saying that it's that, you know, on some level there's an awareness, well, you know, prophetic or whatever, along the lines of what you're suggesting in the words like Yistimeni. It could just be because it's really hard to see Job, who is described as so righteous and so great and is going to be vindicated in the end of this book, calling God his enemy. And it took him 16 chapters to get here. But we're going to leave off with that and pick up, God willing, next week.